So I made this device. This is the first slugometric device. It's a pair of kitchen scissors coupled with a gallery census counter. So when you cut the slug, it counts one on. So we were sort of like doing the thing, but metrification, you know, quantifying the thing to try and sort of work out this balance, how many slugs maketh the man. But then this work extended, because it then became an interesting way of thinking metaphorically about this, the reality of the relationship between the human and nature, with this technosphere in between as an interface. So every act that we make within the natural world is somehow mediated through some piece or multiple part of technology, the technosphere. So in this one, what you do is you close the scissor, which actuates a micro switch, which activates the motor. So you don't actually kill the slug, the motor does it, mm-hmm. but it still counts on. And then this is the third iteration, which those switches on the end there don't actually do anything except for like arm the device. On that device itself, there's no way of making the scissor close, because that responsibility is given to a third person with the radio transmitter. So you've given away the responsibility for your action to a third party, which is very convenient if you don't want to actually sort of face what you're really doing. So yeah, there's lots of works like this came out of the site, and it went on for, the project went on for 5 years. It was kind of successful in terms of being an art project, not so successful in terms of being a system for self-sufficiency, to be honest. but there's various different factors involved in that. One of them is that it took a lot of time, and I was working part-time and also had my practice as an artist, so it's kind of something that needed to be done again with a bit more forward planning perhaps. Excuse me. But then a few years later, I got given the opportunity to make a project at a gallery called Castle Barton, also in Cornwall. And the director of Castle asked me if I would like to sort of continue with this work, but using their site, because they've got this gallery with a small farm around it, and they wanted me to sort of think about that. And it's down in Cornwall on the Lizard. And this is the beginnings of this project called the Lizard Exit Plan. So rather than make a sort of like replica of the project I had already done, I told her that I would like to imagine a scenario where the whole of this peninsula gets cut off from the global economy. And for whatever reason, it was this kind of hypothetical apocalypse, a non-specific apocalyptic event that just meant that this region got decoupled from the economy of global capital. And when I started to look at the region, I just realized that actually it was really apt for this place, because the Lizard Peninsula is very unique geologically, in that it's actually, this part here on the south you can see is actually oceanic crust, which should have been subducted, should have been like sucked back under the crust at the edge of the tectonic plate, but for some sort of compound set of contingent reasons, it didn't go down and it popped back up. So it's already kind of got this rebellious nature. It already wants to be something different. It's this, it has this kind of element of subductive refusal. So it seemed like a perfect place to make this hypothetical kingdom. To try and figure out what it would actually take to allow the population of this peninsula of 9,000 people to become totally self-sufficient. So the first thing is like looking at the carrying capacity of the land and what you can actually grow there. And if you just look back to that, you can maybe vaguely see that this is a map of the land grades. So DEFRA, the Department of Agriculture, gives grading system to land to help farmers decide what they can grow there. And you can see here there's this huge orange patch in the middle, which is kind of barren, because it shouldn't be on the surface of the planet. It should be back down in the molten core. So it's alien and nothing grows there. So this is one of the big problems, like how to deal with that. So the project sort of like became this looking at this meeting point between a sort of the sensibility of the deep ecologists and the sensibility of the survivalist preppers, because you know there's these two completely opposing politics, one of like openness and sort of you know care for the planet, and the other one of like completely individual self-preservation and fairly sort of redneck kind of attitudes. You know these guys that like store guns in underground bunkers. And so. But you find that between these two groups of people, there's this kind of material commonality in the middle, where a lot of the techniques that they're proposing for their systems are actually the same in the middle. So I became quite interested in that. So, basically, it was about looking at population, looking at carrying capacity of the land, looking at geological resources, technological resources, which would be left after this apocalyptic scenario, and trying to figure out a system for using all of this up and making sure that the population could survive in sort of ad infinitum going into the future. A big part of that was like reforestation, because there wasn't enough land with timber crops. So the dark green there is like a proposal for new forest areas all over, and there are just like river valleys and steep slopes which aren't usable for agriculture. And I looked very, very carefully at all of this, and resolution isn't great, but basically I signed all of this research that I amassed from government data and from talking to farmers and talking to geologists, etc., worked out this plan for the exit of the lizard population from the economy of global capital, and divided into three sections, which is like product, techniques and events, product being about food. So that, and then I made a chronology so that all of these changes, these transitions that should take place, have to happen in a certain order and within a certain time scale in order to function. And so it ended up with this document here, this sort of like 76-page executive summary for the lizard to deal with this hypothetical situation. And I produced a set of three blueprints. And the cyanotype blueprint is a really great thing for this, because what I wanted to do was make an artwork that was easily replicable. And cheap to reproduce. So cyanotypes are kind of like two basic chemicals, and you mix them together and then expose it to sunlight. So there was this kind of idea that this could be sort of copied again and again and again if there was this post-apocalyptic scenario where all the Xerox machines didn't work anymore. This is here, if anyone wants to look at this later on, it's like packed full of stuff. And there's loads of real research and real data in there. There's loads of really silly things which only the local population would get, like the summer people contingency, which is what do you do with the tourist population? Because depending on when the apocalypse strikes, there's going to be a different population. In the winter, it's going to be 9,000 people. In the summer, it's going to be like 13,000. So do those extra 4,000 people, do the local people have a moratorium on what happens? Should they put them into slavery? Should they, cook them up and eat them? You know, there was all these like jokes which local people really appreciated, which was nice. A very local project. Some images of that. Oh, here we go. You can see a bit clearer, like sort of the detail. Working out a transition for the whole agricultural economy to horsepower. So how many horses do you need? What labor requirement is there for the production of all of these crops? How many horses does that take? What are they going to eat? Where are they going to live? This is like working out the requirement for timber based on heat loss calculations from the building control office and everything. It's all really like hardcore, but stupid at the same time. Mm-hmm.